Alrighty, here we go. Friday morning, All Saints Day. Hope you had a great Halloween and that everybody was safe and you got a lot of candy and all that kind of stuff. Today, it's raining already this morning. I'll tell you what, today is November 1st, and it felt outside with the humidity. It was 73 degrees like it did the night that Francine passed through. It was that hot and humid, and it's November 1st. So I say this not to have an argument about climate change, but for those of you who, through your thought process, would text me when it's 40 degrees on December 15th and say, where's your climate change? Well, if that's your logic, then you would then have to say me, text me today and say, well, apparently if it's going to be 81 degrees on November 1st, then there's something to it. Highs in 82 today, 82 through the weekend, then going up to 85 next week. Maybe a cold front by next Saturday to bring it down the highs to mid-70s, which is hardly from cold. Presidential election on Tuesday. Matt McCorkle joins us now, a professor of the practice at Duke University's Terry Sanford School of Public Policy. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good, good.
What's going on? You are on the ground in North Carolina, are you not?
I am. Very tight race.
How has, I get them confused, Helene, I guess it is, right, factored into this?
Yes, 25 to 30 counties have been significantly affected in the West. That is usually a stronghold of Republican vote. But Asheville, Buncombe County, was also devastated. And that's a Democratic stronghold. So it's unclear. It appears that people on early voting are voting more than a lot of experts thought. So we'll have to see. A lot of people at first thought that might be a problem for the Republicans, but that's unclear.
So you got the logistics, right? The pragmatic part of it, the political part of it. Trump, I think, was in North Carolina saying that, going back to the Biden thing with the garbage, which, you know, you're garbage, I'm garbage. No, I'm garbage, you're garbage, we're all garbage. I don't know where it stands today, but
yes.
Telling the people of North Carolina that the current administration was treating them like they're garbage. The question I'm asking you is, there in North Carolina, is that message resonating with people? Because the governor said that, no, they're getting everything they need from the federal government, and it just seems as though the Trump campaign are the people pushing that message, not... I don't know. Tell me what the feeling is on.
Yeah. It's part of the extreme Trump message that you would think would be risky. But a number of local Republicans, as they have in other states, have said, no, there is no problem, you know, with the federal government's response. But this is, you know, Donald Trump is not the qualifier or the precision candidate. So, you're right. I mean, he's the one who said the United States had turned into a floating pile of garbage before his comic said that Puerto Rico had. So it's hard to gauge because it's just not like any other conventional politician.
What I find interesting about that is that just having been through Katrina here, right, and knowing what it's like, I guess it goes to everybody's going to be disrupted after a storm like that, right? I know what it was like here, and I'm just wondering, going back then, would I look through it as, all right, the storm, this is a massive storm that devastated a lot of different things, and nothing's going to come back right away, or would I look at it through, this is my guy, this is my woman, this is who I decide to follow, and then, therefore, I'm going to let them dictate my feelings as to the response. Do you understand what I'm trying to ask you?
Exactly. And that's what that has allowed Trump, or has created for former President Trump, perhaps the strongest political base of supporters that we've ever seen. The question is for him, let's say that's 40%, 40, even maybe a little bit more. Can he get to 50? And that, you know, can he get to a majority? Can people who aren't so attracted to that message swing to Trump? And I think that's the big question for this election.
Let me take a break. We'll come back, talk about the path to 270, because I heard a political scientist on TV here saying, you know, the Republicans, I think, by a higher percentage, vastly voted early here in Louisiana, and the political scientist was guessing that was because they wanted to really run up the score for Trump, because Louisiana is solid red in our eight electoral votes. But if people in states where it's not contested feel as though their vote is wasted, or what effect that has on them traditionally if they don't even turn out to vote, and also because it is all about the Electoral College, give me some different paths for each candidate as we talk about these swing states of Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada. We're talking to Mac McCorkle, our friend, professor of the practice at Duke University's Terry Sanford School of Public Policy, about the presidential election. 621 traffic now, WWL. All right, 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mac McCorkle, professor of the practice at Duke University's Terry Sanford School of Public Policy. He's in North Carolina, a swing state, and we're talking about the presidential election on Tuesday. So, Professor, let's talk about, it's all about the electoral votes, popular vote. Okay, if you want to keep score, that's fine, but it doesn't really matter. Let's talk about each candidate's path to 270 and these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 swing states, right?
Yes, yes. Well, the easiest way to understand it is that the Democratic path, the path for Vice President Harris, you take the traditionally blue states, Massachusetts, Vermont, California, New York, the traditionally blue states, plus the states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and the Democrat winning those gets to 270. There's a little,
wait, let me slow you down a little bit. Michigan, Wisconsin,
Michigan, Pennsylvania, in combination with traditionally blue states that people think are usually in the Democratic column, those are the three states that Trump won in 2016 and lost in 2020. If Harris wins those three states and wins the traditionally Democratic states, she gets to 270. The little kink there is that in Nebraska and Maine, she needs to win districts, one district in each state to get there. So she can lose, even though Biden won Nevada, Arizona, Georgia. Trump won North Carolina. So that's the variation. Trump needs to break into the blue state, into the blue wall of Wisconsin, Michigan, or Pennsylvania. If he gets one of those states, then Harris has to repeat the Biden victory somewhere else and gain of a state like North Carolina.
When it comes to, I'm sorry, do you have something else, Professor? I didn't mean to cut you off.
No.
You know, one thing I want to talk about, we talk about swing states, right, and how the other states like Louisiana, it really doesn't matter when it comes to the presidential race because we're solid red, as is Arkansas, Oklahoma. Texas, I'm looking at this map here, and they got that in pink. Is Texas really in play?
Democrats always wish it was in play, and they do have a strong senatorial candidate in all red who's a former Dallas Cowboy. Mm-hmm. But let's just put it this way. If Texas is really, really competitive and Harris has a chance there, it's going to be a very big night for Democrats.
Yeah.
Be surprised.
If Harris carries Texas, then you got some eyebrows raised, and then that, I think, would really send a message to the Republicans. Now, conversely, what would send a message to the Democrats if Trump were to carry, say, I don't know, pick a state that would be
Virginia and New Hampshire.
Okay. So if Trump were to carry Virginia and New Hampshire, that would send a message to the Democrats that the country, or at least that the movement is very much in, how can I phrase this? It'd be the same thing as Harris winning Texas?
Yes.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the swing districts in the swing states, because Maine and Nebraska allocates electoral votes differently than do the other states. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, Professor. And then, when you talk about the districts, how many people are we talking about here?
Well, it's done by population. It's a congressional district. They do it by congressional district. So Maine has two districts and Nebraska has two districts. The district that is Omaha, more urban and university townish, is the one that goes Democratic. And then the Portland area in Maine is the one that goes Democratic. The Republicans were thinking about trying to get trying to change that so that they apportion their votes statewide, whoever won statewide. And one Republican who had said no, and so they weren't able to do it.
So if you had to look into your crystal ball, a McCorkle crystal ball that's been handed down from generation to generation, come on, Mac, you know, you keep it in a, it's a mahogany case, blue velvet, padded, and then in a bag, you take it out, you polish it off, you look into it. Tell me where we're going to be next next Friday, as a matter of fact. Next Friday, November 8th, where we're going to be.
Well, North Carolina will come in should come in fast. We've already had over half of the states, what they think is about half the vote is already in. If you see Harris winning North Carolina, which barely went for Trump last time, you can assume it's going to be a big night for Harris.
Say that one more time.
If not, if Harris wins North Carolina, and that should be a somewhat early indication.
Result, okay.
Then that's going to be a big night for Harris. If you see the other town, for instance, Virginia should come in pretty quickly. If Virginia comes in for Trump, it's going to be a big Trump night. The real issue is that Republicans have been coming out in early voting, which is a good strategy. It was always risky for Republicans to wait to the last day. But what appears to be happening is, and again, we can't exactly tell, but the seems like an overwhelming number of women versus men voting so far.
Professor, we got to run. I'm out of time. I appreciate it. I hope we get to talk to you again.
Right.
So look, if Trump carries Virginia, it's going to be a big night for Trump. If Harris carries North Carolina, it's going to be a big night for Harris, right?
Correct.
Thank you, Professor. A little bit late time for WWL First News. Quickly to Dave Cohen. 6:46, 14 before 7, as a friend texted me a couple of minutes ago, an overly warm Friday morning for November 1st. But what are you going to do? Highs are going to be around 80 or so, then in the mid-80s by next week, and hopefully cooling by next Saturday. But by cooling, we're talking about highs in the mid-70s, which is better than this. Walter, and it's rainy out there, so be careful. Walter Dublane joins us, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO. Talk about tariffs.
Morning, Tommy.
Morning, Professor. How are you?
I'm good.
How's everything at UNO?
Well, we're hanging in there. So.
That's all you can do. God bless y'all, because I know you did a lot for me. Let's talk about tariffs. Former President Trump says that tariffs are the answer. Companies, I see stories, are ready to raise prices. Tell us what a tariff is, how it works out, and who winds up paying for it.
Well, a tariff is just a tax. And just like any other tax, it raises the cost of the goods to the consumer. Now, this is only taxing goods that come from abroad, is what a tariff does. So if you tax the Chinese goods, that means that the price of the Chinese good goes up. And the whole purpose of it is to to get people to buy American goods, but the net effect is that the price goes up. So the consumer, for the most part, pays taxes. Unless it was a pure monopoly, that would be a little different story. But in a general competitive market, when tariff based taxes, the taxes gets passed on to the consumer.
So let's do let me take some case studies here, Dub. Maybe that would help us understand a little bit better. Let's take clothing, let's take appliances, and let's take automobile tires. And I don't know what's made where or whatever products are made. Or maybe we should start the other way first by talking about what products are made and being imported that could be targeted by tariffs.
Well, again, like I say, most of the clothing we do is made abroad. A lot, it used to be made a lot in China. A lot of it has moved down to the Philippines and Vietnam and Bangladesh these days because the wage rates have gone up in China, and so they've gone to cheaper places. But again, those things like particularly, T-shirts and stuff like that, which require a lot of just people sitting at a sewing machine labor, that's where they go to someplace in the world that has cheaper labor. Boston used to be the headquarters of cheap labor in the U.S., and that's clearly not the case these days.
So if we're going to talk about clothing that's made outside in Vietnam, a lot of clothing that I get, I think the jacket I'm wearing right now was made in Vietnam. bought from an American place. So American suppliers, American wholesalers, however you want to phrase it, Joseph Banks, I think, is what this one is. So they buy this, they get this stuff made in Vietnam, and they sell it here. So if a tariff is in place, the jacket that I paid $200 for would go up to, say, what, a 20% tariff would be, what, 220 now?
240, but yes.
240, okay, I'm not a math guy. So, okay, so 240,
that's
thank
okay.
you, Dub.
And of course, I mean, Trump's talking, I mean, of course, he says lots of little things. You know, he's talking about, I'm going to put 100% tariff on some things.
All right, so if that's the case, then it would be a $400 jacket, right?
Right. Okay. And again, I think he tends to, he's focusing more on, well, he says manufactured good. I don't know that clothing is his big target.
What is it? What is a big target?
I think
target?
He has more in mind, you know, tractors and things like that.
So
but
let's
still.
Talk about that. Let me pick up tractors when we come back after the break. So
yeah.
If he's focusing tractors and say a 20% tariff, it would increase the cost of a tractor by 20%. That would be passed on to the consumer with the end goal of, well, heck, if we're going to pay 20% more for tractors, we may as well do it with American labor and have them manufactured here. Well, did that 20%, do those numbers add up in terms of increased cost of labor? If people are going to be paying 20% more, does that mean then that you could make a tractor in the United States and only cost 20% more? But either way, the person that buys that tractor is going to wind up paying 20% more. As I understand it, you can pick it up there. We come back, 651, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:55, quickly back to Walter Dublane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at UNO, talking about tariffs. So we can put a 20% tariff on an imported tractor, which means that the incentive is for people to start manufacturing them here, Dub, and stop importing tractors, yes?
Yeah, that's the point.
So does the math...
But the only question is, who pays for that? And the answer is the people buying the tractors.
So does the math work out?
Exactly the whole 20%. You know, I mean, it could be the Americans now can produce it for 10% more and would be worthwhile. But the point is the price will go up, and the people that will pay for it is going to be the people that buy the tractors.
But a key part in this is, does it work? Does the math work with the percentage of the tariff to entice American companies to build tractors here? And then so what happens is they would be able to build tractors here and still make a profit. It would cost 20% more than it does now because they'd have to pay more for labor than the imported model, but there would be economic gains of that. However, the consumer would still have to pay for that. Am I on track here?
Yeah, and again, yes, the that's the point. There's a sense in which it would work, except what you got to remember is the other half of it is if we're putting tariffs on their goods, they're going to do what's called reciprocal tariffs on our goods. And so the people are now we buy a lot from China. We buy a lot more from China than we send to them, but we send a lot of things to China. And now the manufacturers of the goods that we send abroad, they're going to be hurt because their prices are going to go up in China and they won't be buying from us anymore. So we'll help some industries, but we'll hurt other ones.
So I don't care if it's Kamala Harris, Donald Trump, Mitt Romney or Grover Cleveland, if they were to put tariffs on goods economically, does it work or can you not say it that generally? Does it depend on what country, what product, et cetera?
Well, yeah, there are some specific cases. In fact, I think there are some cases for doing some tariffs on China because of certain unfair trade practices. But the thing that kind of worries me the most is he wants to start taxing all imports, you know, from Europe. That would be a killer. One of the things we know historically is that everybody gains from free trade. In general, free trade makes both parties richer. Now, sometimes there's certain industries that will gain, other industries will lose. But on average, everybody goes up before free trade. So a huge tariff policy will basically make us poorer is the net effect, as well as the other people.
So how does that factor in with inflation? Because if you do put tariffs on goods, it's going to end ultimately being paid for by the end user?
Yeah. So the tariffs will be, it's a raise in the cost of goods. That'll show a raise in prices, inflation, yes. That would cause inflation.
So generally speaking, as an economist, you would say when it comes to tariffs,
that I'm in favor of keeping them down. Now, so there's some selected cases. I could say I think we can make a case for doing some things with China if we coordinate with some of our partners in Europe and stuff like that. But just tariffs in general, I mean, for instance, you know, the free trade agreement we signed with Mexico and Canada, used to be called NAFTA, that really helped. I mean, specific industries were hurt by that. There's absolutely no doubt. And the ones that are hurt are usually very visible. So in other words, it's like 80 industries get helped and one gets destroyed. And so you always pay attention to the one that gets destroyed. But in general, free tariffs make both parties better off.
Thank you.
But it does hurt certain individual industries.
Have a good weekend. Thank you. We'll talk to Jan Mueller about the Landry administration's tax plan. 7:15 on a rainy Friday morning, November 1st. And I would like to open the Oakenhart Jeweler talk and text line here. You can call in if you like at 504-260-1870, or you could text in at 504-260-1870. I wouldn't like a campaign speech for either candidate, but what I would like...
Jim was at the laundromat when he heard... His ear said, "Maracas, senor," but his nose said, "Hey, freshest scent ever." Following his nose, Jim found a man pouring Gain scent beads into the washer. The scent, the freshness. Jim blurted, "Sir, your scent maracas smell amazing." You could call them scent maracas, but most noses call them Gain scent beads. Try Gain scent beads, way fresher than detergent alone.
In case we haven't met, I'm Dino Colombo. I represent people hurt by a truck. It's what we do every day. Justice isn't just a word, it's your right. We'll stand up for you when others can't. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.
I'd like to ask you is what advice would you give to a voter as it relates to the election on Tuesday about how to pick a candidate? And what I mean by that is not the qualities of Trump or the qualities of Harris or the perceived faults of Trump or the perceived faults of Harris or real or perceived, however you want to phrase this. But what would you look for in a president? Because I was thinking about this the other day, and I think when people go into the booth, you got to vote for a couple of different things. I think the first thing is, and no matter how I say this, you're going to hear it negatively. You're not going to think that I'm talking about your person. You're going to think I'm talking against your person. And in fact, I'm not talking about either. I'm just saying in general, what do you look for in a presidential candidate? Does character matter? I think the first thing, whether it's Harris or Trump, that you need to look for is when they tell you or somebody shows you who they are, believe them. Because Trump is not going to change. Harris is not going to change when they get in the White House. They are who they are. And it's not as though you got somebody that showed up from somewhere and you don't know exactly who they are. Because I know, you know, they said that Harris had introduced herself to the voters, but she's been vice president for 4 years. So I think everybody pretty well knows. I don't know how, if you're a Trump supporter, you can say you don't know who Harris is, but then you can run her down like you do. Or if you're a Harris supporter, you can say you don't know who Trump is, and then you can run him down. Because apparently you do have a feel for who they are. So I guess the first thing I would say is, when somebody shows you who they are, believe them. And don't think that just because they get elected that they're going to change, whether it's Harris or whether it's Trump or whether it's anybody else. The other thing I think you would look for is, who would you trust to run your personal finances? Who would you give access to your 401k, to your checking account, to your day-to-day finances, take financial advice from, etc.? Who would you trust to babysit your kids if you were out of town? Or maybe to be the guardian of your kids if you die? Because if you think about it, that's kind of what's going to happen here. And I saw somebody doing a piece the other day where it's a shame that the people that are in power are older. I don't care if you're 50, 60, 70, and they're making policies that they're not going to really have to deal with because they'll be dead and gone, and it's the people behind them that will have to deal with the policies. That, of course, is offset by the fact that maybe somebody that's 25 or 30 thinks they know, but they really don't know how the world works. So where does that factor in? Would you vote for somebody that you wouldn't trust to be the guardian of your kids if you were to die? Because it's basically what's going to happen. presuming everything works as it's supposed to work and the parents die before the children, then the country's going to be left for them. And the people that are in the White House, along with the people that are in the Senate and the House, are going to have a lot to do with what the country looks like. So in essence, they are going to be the guardians of your children in the future, right? So does that enter into it? Does character enter into it? Do you think somebody can do this or that in their past life, either way, and then that doesn't really matter when it comes to running the country or being the role model for the country? And should the president be the role model for the country, or should the president just be the CEO, the CAO, the person that's in charge of the business decisions protecting the country, etc.? I think the other thing is, who is it that can best represent the country? When you're talking to foreign dignitaries, because a lot of this does come down to personal, you know, it's the president of this and the prime minister of that, but when you get right down to it, it's Fred and it's Alice, right? I mean, when they talk to each other, you would think. So who is it that's best able to represent the country? Who is it that's best able to negotiate for the country, to stand strong for the country, to make sure that the other countries know that if they do this, then that's going to happen, to not just maybe be a blunt force object, but also be able to be an iron fist in a velvet glove, as they say, right? So I just want to know, when it comes to choosing a presidential candidate, does any of that enter into your mind at all? Or do you automatically fall into red or blue, conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat, or just the personalities involved? Never Trump, never Harris. Give me a call or text me, 504-260-1870. I'd like to know. 721 Traffic Now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. Talk about Governor Landry's tax plan and tax reformation. Well, I guess reformation would be a good way to put it. Sounds like a Protestant reformation. It's not that serious. Daniel, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
I was talking to Richard Nelson yesterday, and we've been talking about this all week. Special session's going to start next week. Man, I don't know how you get people to understand everything that's going on. Do you have an easy way to explain this or to explain people why what the governor's trying to do is in their best interest?
Yeah, let me take a crack at it. So first, let's say, try to define the problem. The problem is a tax code that's too complicated, that's Byzantine, really. It's outdated. And so what happens is it drives jobs and ultimately our friends, neighbors, and kids and grandkids to other states. So the solution that's being presented is something that is trying to flatten taxes, make them fairer, broader-based, and easier to understand and comply with, and ultimately phase out the personal income tax, making us more competitive with the states around us so that we can become the powerhouse of opportunity and economic growth that really we ought to be given our state's assets.
What still needs to be worked out, Daniel? Because you said fairer, and let's face it, not everything's always going to be perfectly fair or advantageous to everybody. That's not the way life works,
sure,
right? It just can't be. But what you have to do is try to think, I guess this is all about balancing the best interest of everybody in the state, the business interest, the personal interest, et cetera, and hoping that you wind up with a system that's more workable and advantageous for the majority of people.
Yeah, that's right. You know, you try to maximize the winners and minimize the losers. And that's where you get, when we talk about fair, what good, fair, what we would call fair tax policy is everyone has some stake in the game, right? If there, that means fewer special treatments, ideally no special treatments. Everyone is on the same playing field and everyone pays the same. So that's why we prefer things like a flat tax. This is while we're in the process of phasing out the personal income tax, instead of having three or four different brackets, we have one flat tax. Everybody pays the same. Same thing on the corporate side. You know, we've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. We've 432 pages of special tax preferences in the corporate tax code. And, you know, if you have one group or one company or one industry paying less over here, that means somebody else has to pay more in order to raise the same amount of revenue to pay for government. So this is about trying to even the playing field. And yes, you know, that there's because of the complexity of the system, there's likely to be some losers in the process while we get this worked out. But by and large, every taxpayer, every individual taxpayer would get a tax cut under this plan, and it gets the process going to really get to something that will drive economic growth.
Daniel, thank you for helping us understand that. I know we'll talk to you more as the special session begins and proceeds, and there's going to be some tweaks and some changes here or there. Complicated
for
stuff.
Sure.
Thanks for trying to help us understand it.
Anytime.
Have a great weekend.
Me.
All right, we'll take a break. We come back. We're going to help you manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union, as we always do. Right now, 7:30 on a button. Time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, Friday morning. It's time to manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. If you can, you can go to jeffersonfinancial.org safely. I mean, do this, not while you're driving or anything. You'll see in the middle of the page, manage your money and plan for your future with our financial calculators. And when you click on that, a lot of valuable information there, man, a lot of different calculators. And then we welcome in Mark Rosa. How you doing, Mark?
How are you, sir? Happy Friday to you. It's a little too warm.
Yo,
geez. But Friday, nonetheless.
But it's Friday, and that's the main thing, and it seems like it's been a long week. What are we talking about today, Mark?
Well, on the eve of the election, so much information disseminates about the candidates, and people find themselves squarely in somebody's camp. And it just seems like their policies are so diametrically opposed. And when it came to taxes, you know, I really focus in on that because I would rather pay less than more. Imagine that. And, you know, you have the tax cuts that Trump installed in 2017. They're expiring in 2025. And the candidates are kind of, you know, it's a big deal. And a lot of people would say, well, Trump lowered taxes too much in 2017. But when Biden got into office, he was a little bit loath to raise those taxes, because imagine that. I'm imagining that a lot of them don't want to pay higher taxes either. And here we come on. So it's obviously a hot potato with respect to the politics of it and who's going to what they're going to do with things. But the diametrically opposed part to taxes, I mean, it just goes right down the line as far as taxes, Trump's saying he wants to lower taxes even further and bring, let's say, corporate taxes from 21% down to 15%. It was already brought down significantly from the previous rates that were in the 30s. It brought down to 21. And that's such a big deal, because you imagine the zillions of dollars that corporations will earn, and they're taxed at, you know, significantly less. And if it gets to the 15%, that's probably about half of what they used to pay. So as a rate. So, I mean, these are big deals. They're going to cause stimulus in the economy. He wants to cut individual taxes as well. He wants to offer business incentives through the tax code. And all that's going to be stimulative to the economy. And it seems, you know, the GOP or that group likes that more flexibility for the individual. And the Harris camp is saying, no, we're going to cut taxes. We're going to make sure that people making under $400,000 are not going to pay what they currently pay. We'll offer right there. And some more tax incentives for the lower income people. So that's going to be economic incentives, money that's directly paid to them from the government. But we need to raise, how we're going to pay for that in part by raising taxes on people that make over $400,000 and corporations. The 21% can't last long. They want to bring that up. And any investment, which is a really killer for investment incentive and people that put their money into investing in companies so the companies can flourish, we need to install a fairly, if Biden had his way, it would be like 40% tax on capital gains. So what a difference in the tax policies, but both of them could be very stimulative to the economy, and that's the way a lot of times the policies are kind of structured, you know, for the talking points. And I guess at the time within both of these, they got some sector specifics talking from a money standpoint. And, Harris's policies would tend to lean more towards favoring the Teslas and the SunPower companies, using specific names, and then major pharmaceutical companies, because she wants to do a lot of push towards health care. I think they would prefer a more government intervention in healthcare than less. And so that might help those companies. You're going to have people who benefit by that. And on the on Trump's side, the sectors who might benefit most, who might go to companies like Exxon and the major oil companies, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank America, I think he'd be friendly to finance, and Lockheed Martin, another company that, you know, is a large company within the economy that might benefit from Trump policies. But what worries me is all of them are stimulative. You can't run, I guess, for politics and say, you know, I'm really going to pull the growth rate of the economy down, and we really need to get this get things in order. And none of my policies are going to be stimulative. They're going to kind of be anti-stimulative. And you can't win elections like that. So I worry about inflation, naturally, because I think both of them could, in their own way, reignite the inflation that the Fed is working so hard to contain. And more for the Monday segment, but, just this week, the Fed's preferred inflation gauge came out, and it was right as expected at 0.2%. Okay, that's okay. But on an annualized rate, it's at 2.4, and I think they would prefer it to come down a little bit less. And I think we as a group, as Americans, have, you know, we've seen the inflation rate come up, hit a high a couple of years ago, but it's not come down. That's what you were just talking about, insurance rates. Are they ever going to come down? A lot of people are saying, well, the inflation is growing at this very anemic rate, but the focus is on the operative word growing. It keeps adding on. So, you know, to solve that, I've always said, well, you probably need a recession to have this growth rate become negative and prices really start to pull back. But it's between the inflation, and nobody is talking about the deficit. Some estimates are Trump's tax policies, if he gets what he wants and he does what he wants, it's going to be about a $9 trillion increase in the deficit over 10 years. He's going to add tariffs. I was listening to my boss at UNO, Dr. Lane, talk about the tariffs. The tariffs are expected to bring in about $2.7 trillion over 10 years if installed at a rate that he wants to bring them in. Harris, the cost of the deficit is going to raise it about $6 trillion over 10 years. And both of them are adding to an already ballooned deficit that's growing at about $1 trillion. The interest is about $1 trillion a year. And that's what's worrisome. Somebody commented online, it's like the 24 election, nobody's talking about the deficit. The 28 election, everybody's going to have to be talking about the deficit because it's going to be, you know, who knows, some estimates are as high as close to $50 trillion, and it's just unfathomable number. But it's as far as managing investments, we've seen economic downturns, we've seen recessions before, we've seen elections before, and if people are just minding their investments and understanding what they own, you know, the S&P 500 or sufficiently diversified portfolios should keep you safe through anybody's administration. And it's just to understand, I think that's the biggest key. People, even in 401ks, Tommy, I see people at work that they would be really hard-pressed to explain to anybody, including themselves, what exactly do you own in your 401k? And what is it supposed to do? And why did you choose a particular fund? And I think people would be hard-pressed. So it's not a bad idea. It is your money, and it's your money when you're trying to retire, and you'd want more than less. So educate yourself on what is in your portfolio. And if you want a high-flying portfolio with a lot of volatility in it, well, elections tend to be accused of introducing a lot of volatility, and you might have more depending on which side of the fence that your investments are on. And if you have a conservative portfolio, you might not see a whole lot of change in what the investments that you've chosen previously, regardless of either candidate. But it's that's the focus of how do you take your investments through an election year where people are so polarized, the economy seems to be so divided, and it adds a lot of uncertainty for people that they're trying to make those choices.
Mark, very interesting information. I know we got a new jobs report. I will talk about that on Monday with you as we take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Thank you, sir. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Tommy.
You bet.
You too, sir.
7:54, 6 till 8. Traffic now, WWL.
In case we haven't met, I'm Dino Colombo. I represent people hurt by a truck. It's what we do every day. Busy roads, big trucks, bigger risks. Don't face it alone. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.
Downy Rinse and Refresh. Break up with stinky clothes.
Rinse it out.
Every now and then I get a little bit tired of the stinks that just will never come out.
Oh. Down in the rinse straight.
Every now and then I rinse it out. One wash and it delivers. One wash, it smells so clean.
Downy Rinse and Refresh, it's a dream.
Downy Rinse and Refresh. Fights odor in just one wash. Guaranteed.
I ain't giving up, I'll tell you that. Saints taking on the Panthers this weekend. Our coverage starts at 8 o'clock. Mike Dettelier is going to be part of that coverage. He joins us now. I guess we're getting it started now. How you doing, Mike?
I'm fine, Tommy. Thank you.
Let's talk about the Panthers before we get into the game and the state of disrepair that that team is in. How did they get to where they are?
Tommy, it didn't take much. And it all fell apart for them. Bad drafts. And Jerry Richardson, the original owner, had to sell. And he had a lot of money.
He was an NFL player, Jerry Richardson, was he not? Do you remember
yes.
that right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, he was with the old Baltimore Colts. Okay. And he ended up selling. And, man, ownership says a lot in the NFL. They got a live wire, no insulation owner. And he has been very impatient. He has meddled in number of draft choice and free agent decisions. And it has hit rock bottom. Basically, that's what's happened. And he was the main guy, because I do think then head coach Frank Wright wanted C.J. Stroud as the first overall pick. But I think the owner got himself involved, and he said, no, I want Bryce Young. He's going to put butts in the seats, and that's who I want. And when the boss says that's the way it is, that's the way it is. And so, you got where you stuck today. And their offensive line, I'll be honest, that's the strength of their football team. They've spent a lot of money and some early round picks on offensive linemen. They got a pretty good offensive line, very good. But after that, everything else is really, really bad. And in a strange decision this week with a healthy Andy Dalton, who has practiced the last two practices, they decided they're going back to Bryce Young as the starter. In a press conference or interview after the workout yesterday, Andy said, I'm ready to go. I'm healthy, but I will not play in the game. He had basically been told not playing. So guess where that came from?
Yep.
So you are where you are today. Listen, we had one here in New Orleans for years.
Mike, I was John getting
Beacom
ready.
Jr.
I was getting
John
ready.
John Beacom Jr. was exactly like him.
Yep, make that comparison, because today is All Saints Day, as you well know. David Tepper is a hedge fund manager. He's 67 years old, not to criticize, just telling you. He's got a 36-year-old wife, God bless him. I don't know what they talk about other than, you know, money. I don't think he's got a football background at all, and I feel, in a way, you got to feel bad for the fans of North Carolina, yeah, the Panthers, because there's nothing anybody can do, right? I mean, he owns a team. He's a billionaire, $60-something billion dollars he's worth, $36 billion, I think.
So, this is a Diliberto line, because back then, if you were a sports writer, or on television, you could get in touch with the commissioner, actually speak to him. And Buddy had told me numerous times he had gotten on the phone and told then Commissioner Pete Rozelle, you got to do something about John Meacham Jr. You got to do something. And he said, Buddy, I can do a lot of things, but I can't make a bad owner sell. Mm-hmm. And no one else can. And so David Tepper at one time was a minority owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers. That was his connection to the NFL. He had bought a piece of the Pittsburgh Steelers years ago, and so many of the owners knew him and knew he had deep pockets. And so when ownership came up when Richardson had to sell, he was able to buy it.
David Tepper played touch football in the streets and tackle football in a nearby cemetery. That's his football experience. But yet, if he got the money, and look, the commissioner, make no mistake about it, works for the owners, and I think the owners are afraid that if one turns on the other and forces somebody to sell a team, who knows where it leads, right?
Correct. I mean, the only time, this was a couple years back, well, 2 years ago, you could say, Dan Snyder basically got forced to sell the Washington Commanders. He had so many issues with him.
But that was beyond mismanagement of the team.
Way beyond mismanagement. But he was forced to sell the team. But he said, I'll sell it, but only at my price. Mm-hmm. You're not going to force me to do anything. So he got his price, and he ended up selling to Josh Harrison and the group that Mr. Harris had pieced together. But, yeah, once you stuck with an owner, you might think you have the power as a fan or whatever to get him to sell. It's not going to happen. They own the team. And like I said, hey, we had that happen right here in New Orleans for over 20 years.
And, you know, I'm not trying to run this guy down or anything like that, but Tom Benson, at least, didn't have football experience, but he had business experience. He bought and sold things. This hedge fund manager, he just kind of worked with math and derivatives, and that's not the way a business works. That's certainly not the way the NFL works, at least in on the field part of it.
The worst thing is, I think, Tommy, that when you've made that type of money, you've made it fairly quick. And I think Mr. Tepper feels as though that the same thing will happen in sports, that I can turn this around like I have in other businesses and other things I've invested in. And it's not necessarily the case. You kind of got to know what you're doing and put really good people in place. The one thing you can say with Tom Benson, he got Jim Finks. Mm-hmm. Jim was an experienced NFL guy, and he knew the lays of the land of the NFL. And that really, really put this franchise, its opening couple of steps, even though they were, basically 20 years old, it took them that long to get it. But Tom Benson was smart enough to bring in somebody that knew what he was doing, and Jim Finks knew what he was doing.
Let's take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I guess it's good for the Saints that they're going back to Bryce Young, right?
Yeah, I think Andy Dalton gave them the best chance to win.
All right, we'll take a break. Come back with Mike Dettelier talking about the Saints-Panthers game. Our coverage starts at 8 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, kickoff high noon. Please do yourself a favor. Turn down the sound. Turn up. Mike Haas and Deuce McAllister, who a lot of times can predict stuff before it happens, and Jeff Nowak on the sideline. They know the team, and you're going to get more insight into the game than you will from whomever's working the game this weekend on the TV. 821 traffic now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Mike Dettelier about the Saints-Panthers game coming up on Sunday. Already we know that it's going to be Bryce Young back to playing quarterback, not the Red Rocket, Andy Dalton, whom Mike said, and I agree with him, I think would have a better chance at beating the Saints. But that being said, Mike, it's the NFL. Saints can't just roll their helmets on the field and expect to walk away with a win.
Tommy, I said this on Sports Talk last night and doing this is, I think I've done four shows in the Charlotte area that, they're talking about if the Panthers have a path to another win this year, it's the Saints. Mm-hmm. And people here are saying just the same thing about the Panthers. Hey, this is a shot to get a W up on the board and try to piece something together. So, yeah, they're talking about, hey, we think we got a shot here against New Orleans. And, when you do shows and take calls and texts and everything, hey, you got to beat the Panthers because of how bad they are. So, yeah, it's kind of versus vice, as they would say, on both sides.
And all of that David Tepper stuff, that's got nothing to do with the guys that are putting on the equipment and having tape out there on themselves, and they got pride, right? I mean, you would hope they do.
Yeah, I think the biggest difference in years past, the Carolina Panthers always had a really good defense. Their defense, no matter what they had on offense, their defense was really good. You can't say that this year. They lousy. And it's funny, before the season started, I got Jake Delhomme to come on the show, and there were people that were picking them to win 5 or 6 games, and Jake was like, 5 or 6 games? Who's picking them to win 5? There's no way they're going to win 5 or 6 games this year. And Jake made the comment, and he's part of the Panthers radio network. He said they would be lucky to win 2 to 3. Now he could see that there wasn't a lot of talent on this team. There was some young players that could possibly develop. But even Jake kind of laid it out that this isn't a very good football team. And he sort of forecasted that they're going to have some major difficulties.
Let me get back to that in a minute. I want to talk about Chuba Hubbard. He's on his way to 1,000-yard season, seemingly. I think he's like at 539 yards rushing so far, about halfway through the season. How hard is it going to be for the Saints to contain him?
Stop. Yeah, well, that's part of the victory. You got to stop the running game of the Panthers, because that's what they do pretty well. And Chuba Hubbard has really played well this year. But he's playing behind a pretty good offensive line from a run-blocking standpoint. The other part about it is there is a good chance that they get their second-round pick, Jonathan Brooks, back. Jonathan was a second-round pick from Texas. He tore his ACL in November of last year. And he was my 22nd overall-rated player. Mm-hmm. But I knew he wouldn't get picked in round one because of the ACL injury. So he fell into the second round. He is practicing, so he's looking pretty good. That's a really strong 1-2 punch if you can get Brooks and Chuba Hubbard in the lineup. That, for the Saints, got to stop the run, and you got to have a running game, because the Panthers are vulnerable to teams just sort of pounding away at them. And then once they do that, safeties cheat up, throw the ball over the top.
And if you got, Chuba Hubbard or Jonathan Brooks running a ball, doesn't really matter whether it's Andy Dalton or Bryce Young. If you can't stop that, you're dead in the water. So we'll talk about it when we come back. Mike Dettillier, our guest, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. Derek Carr is supposed to be back. Steve Geller, on his sports report, named a couple of cornerbacks that the Saints could call up. I looked them up and I couldn't find them, so I don't know. We'll talk to Mike Dettillier about that as well. Then in the 9 o'clock hour, we will talk to Ian McNulty, who covers food and dining for the Times, speaking of New Orleans Advocate. And we'll wrap it up getting you some weekend winners with JR from Taking Vegas. 8:30, time for WWL First News. 8:44, 16 till 9, Tommy Tucker talking to Mike Dettillier, talking about the Carolina game coming up on Sunday, noon kickoff. Our coverage starts at 8 on WWL. Mike, when it comes to, I was mentioning earlier that Steve Geller was talking about the Saints bringing up a couple of guys from cornerback, I've never heard of them. Tell me about the Carolina receivers and who the Saints could be looking at starting at cornerback.
Well, because of all the injuries, Tommy, you're always going to have injuries. But when it hits in one place, like the Saints have at cornerback, you go into your practice squad, you go out looking for veterans. That's why they signed Trey Herndon this week. Trey was a guy I scouted coming out of Vanderbilt. He was an undrafted free agent, and he played a number of seasons with the Jacksonville Jaguars, actually started there for a while. And they just picked him up. And Shamir John-Charles, who was in the Saints camp, he got into the training camp period. He was cutting the last cut for them. And he's played with Green Bay, San Francisco, and, training camp and preseason with the Saints. But you all beat up there. So you need those veteran corners who have sort of bounced around. They've been journeymen. Panthers receiving core, the one guy that sticks out to me is Xavier Leggett, who was their first-round pick. They moved up in round one to get him from South Carolina. Thickly built receiver. He's got some speed. He's learning how to run NFL routes. They do have Adam Thielen, but he's been hurt also. So, they got Trey Sanders at tight end. another rookie from Texas. Their receiving core is not great, and they got a young rookie from the Ivy Leagues also has made some catches, who was on the practice squad for a while. So, you know, it's not like you're going up against Justin Jefferson and Ja'Marr Chase here. But first things first, stop the run, and then you put some pressure on Bryce Young and see whoever's playing receiver for him, they're going to have some difficulties.
Why have they had so much trouble stopping the run?
Tommy, it's a great question. They have spent a lot of capital on the interior of that defensive line and bringing in Nathan Shepard, okay, Colin Saunders from Kansas City. Shepard came from the Jets. You spent a first-round pick on Brian Bresee. And Brian's sort of what the scouting report said about him. Athletic, he's a huge guy, and he can run the field. But the way he's built, he gives you a lot of body coming off the snap to get under and move around against the run. And he's got to just learn how to play lower, because if he's in there, I'm running the ball right at him. Mm-hmm. Now, he can maybe get my quarterback as a pass rusher, and he's pretty good with that. But as a run stuffer, he's still learning how to play lower, because if you cut out of that snap high, and he's 6'5" plus, and, you know, those guards and centers are going to get under him and move him around. Personnel hasn't lived up to the billing against the run. Bottom line.
I don't think you have to be Vince Lombardi to realize that if one team can't stop the run, then the other team's going to keep running it down their throat until they do. So,
yeah, and for all the talk about this has become a pitch-and-catch league, and to a certain extent it really has. Man, look who's getting paid today. Quarterbacks, wide receivers, a lot of money.
But
it is back to old school, and I hear it every the last couple years when they have Louisiana Line Camp here at Nicholls State and Thibodeau. We've probably got a dozen coaches, NFL coaches, and their deal is this game is changing, and it's gradually it's going back to what they still got the pitch and catch part of it, but teams are running the football because you know what? NFL teams got smaller on defense. They're trying to match up against the three wide receiver sets, the flex tight end, so you got smaller. The linebackers today look like safeties mm-hmm. in a lot of cases.
Yep.
So as you get smaller, guess what I do? I pound the ball at you with big guys.
Action.
And so now you've got to adjust.
Action and reaction, right? Cyclical?
Correct.
And you'd have to be beyond a damn fool. And look, I see it all the time in college football. You see it too, Mike, in the NFL. Man, you're picking up 3, 4 yards a carry, 5 yards a carry. So what are you going to do after 3 first downs? Start throwing it. Why? Why would you do that? Do you understand that?
You sound just like Mark Schlereth. Because Mark, you know, he does games for Fox, and he's a weekly visitor with us on Sports Talk. And he's told me, Mike, I've been hired like a consultant for some teams, and they say they want to run the ball but really don't. They run it a couple times. They get 5 yards total, but then they go back to throwing it. You say, you know, it's got to be they wear you down. If anybody watched the Tulane game last night, good gracious, Charlotte had no shot. Tulane's drives, they were multi, like 10, 11, 12 play drives on every one, and that wears you down defensively. And the same thing in the NFL. Man, when you play the Ravens and they decide they're going to run the football with Derrick Henry and they got Lamar Jackson, good luck with that. You got some issues there. And I think it has been a part. The Saints didn't think this through when they went to this Kubiak system, because what you had to have depth at running back and you had to have depth along the offensive line. Those positions up front are going to get hurt, and you basically got everybody injured. But then you had no depth at running back. If you're going to run that system, you have to know what you got to have to run that system. And that's where it failed here. Look at the 49ers. They're not the same team as a year ago, but they're successful in offense. They can still run the ball.
Let me take a break real quick, Mike. We'll pick it up. We come back with the Saints offense. And people that don't understand this, offensive lineman mentality is once you start, and I don't want to say what Kelsey guy had to say on TV because it was a little bit off color, but once, you know what I'm saying? Once you dominate the guy in front of you, and that's how offensive linemen think, they want to keep doing it. And it's more about pure physical force than it is technique when it comes to run blocking. And when you're on a roll, don't stop. I don't know why they do, but they do. 852, 8 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 856, 4 till 9, wrapping it up with Mike Dettelier, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. And, of course, he'll be on with the Saints pregame coverage. Starts at 8 o'clock on Sunday. Mike, tell me about Derek Carr, Saints offense, and the Carolina defense, and how likely you think it is that the Saints win.
Well, I'm going to go back to the running game. Mm-hmm. The Washington Commanders have been a surprise this year, and certainly Jaden Daniels and what he's been able to do is phenomenal. But a big reason why the Commanders are successful, they're one of the top three teams rushing the ball in the NFL. Now, Jaden's a big part of that, too, because, man, when he takes off, he scares you. But they've been able to pound the ball into something. Dan Quinn, when he took the job, said, we are going to run the football. I can guarantee you. And they're one of the top three rushing teams in the NFL today. And, again, Daniels is a part of that. But it goes to show you when you got that running game, what you can do off of it. And a lot of play action and being able to throw the football. Derek Carr looks as though he's enrolled that he is going to start against the Panthers. And, you know, after watching the two young guys, you know, Derek Carr gives you the best chance to win. Mm-hmm. And no matter how you cut it, for now, he gives you the best chance to win. And you need this win. You need to get a W up on the board. Tommy, I cannot remember a team that wins their first two games, loses the last six, and they are 7.5-point favorite on the road. Think of that.
Mm-hmm.
You're a 7.5-point favorite over a team, and you've lost six straight. That's what the people who they earn their money, that's what they think of the Panthers.
But again,
age of the game.
These are professionals. This is the NFL. You can't go in presuming anything.
Yeah, even last night, and we were doing this during the week, they were like, I don't understand how the Texans are a 2.5-point underdog to the Jets Thursday night.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing is desperation for the Jets. They needed a win in the worst way, and they were able to get it last night. Now, it was some ugly football with the Jets. But Aaron Rodgers late, you know, he came through for him and was able to pull it out. And, man, the Texans are a pretty doggone good football team in this league. But the Jets were able to run the ball a little bit last night. And Garrett Wilson, man, late in the game, he came through big for him.
So, prediction?
Oh, I think the Saints win and they cover. I've seen nothing from the Panthers to tell me that they may get another win somewhere this season. Tommy, I have no idea where. And, again, I think if they get the win, Andy Dalton will be the quarterback.
You know,
it won't be Bryce. Bryce looks like a deer in the headlights at this point.
It's funny how you can have two highly motivated teams that are in top of the division competing for home field advantage, or you can have two highly motivated teams that are desperate for a win, and that's what we got here.
That's the Diliberto line. Always bet the desperation.
Really?
But in this game, both teams are desperate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Azana. I live in Columbus, Ohio. When we vote, we send a message that we will be heard. And with so much at stake, our fundamental right to vote is on the line. We can't afford to miss this chance. Vote by November 5th.
Paid for by the Ohio Democratic Party, www.ohiodems.org. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
In case we haven't met, I'm Dino Colombo. I represent people hurt by a truck. It's what we do every day. Busy roads, big trucks, bigger risks. Don't face it alone. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.
I hope the Saints win.
Both teams are desperate for a win.
Thank you, Mike. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Tommy.
All right, take it easy. We'll listen for you tomorrow at Rouse's with Bobby Hebert in Gulfport. We're going to take a break. We come back, we'll talk to Ian McNulty. He covers food and dining for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, our favorite time of week as we get to lighten up a little bit, especially with all the Saints' desperation and LSU's off this weekend and the presidential contest. We'll take a break from all that and just talk about having fun eating and drinking with Ian McNulty. When we come back, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Yep, reminder about daylight savings time. You got to set the clock ahead tomorrow. Wait, spring forward, fall back. You set it back. It's not getting away from the, because if three goes into four. At this time, Monday, it'll be 8:10. Yeah, if that makes any sense to you. All right, Dave, thank you. Have a great weekend. Ian McNulty joins us now. It's time to talk some eating and drinking. He covers food and dining culture for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate. Y'all got any questions about where to eat, where to drink? 504-260-1870. That's the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text Line. I'll pass it along to Ian as we proceed through the conversation. How you doing, Ian McNulty? What have you been eating and drinking?
Tommy, doing great. Good to hear your voice there. I'm just polishing off a breakfast sandwich here with a Reese's peanut butter cup with Kit Kats as the bread.
There you go.
With some twist gummy bears on the side. Little leftovers lounge going on over here after Halloween.
Did you have a good Halloween?
It was a grand one. Yeah, it was a grand one. I live in Mid-City, and I live in this particular block that the kids have staked out, it seems, for generations now. Way, way, way more kids show up than live anywhere in the radius around us, and it's wonderful. I love it. The neighbors get into it. We got music rocking, lights going, adults in costumes encouraging the kids, and it's a really good scene. I'm glad it happens every year, and it still happened last night despite the early rain. They must have been holed up in their little hobbit holes waiting to emerge, and then all sorts of Harry Potter wizards and Transformers and X-Men came swarming out, and we did our level best to ruin their diets, at least for the day. So it good time was had by all.
Did you costume or not?
Oh, yes, of course.
As?
I was a caveman.
Okay.
And so sort of a picture of tunic made of various furs of, largely extinct and sometimes fictional animals from the prehistoric past, and more hair than I'm normally sporting. More hair than I've sported since I was a head-banging metalhead back in middle school days. Okay. So that was the look.
All right. Tell me where you've been eating, where you've been drinking.
All right. It's been a really interesting week for food, my friend, since last we spoke. Oh, actually, we've had 2 weeks off. I missed you last week. I was on the road.
Yeah.
But the New Orleans food scene did not stop. And actually, there were two really interesting two food festivals with interesting results in the past week. Top Taco in Metairie, which is a taco contest and festival where people wander around, try all the different tacos from these various vendors and vote on them, and judges do the same. And then Po' Boy Fest on Oak Street, that was on Sunday, which follows the same format. Lots of vendors, lots of people, and then judges voting on the best ones. And the same spot won the grand champion of both places. And I'm leading with this on today's chat because I think it's really noteworthy. Both the taco competition and the po' boy competition were won, swept, you might say, by a small barbecue place in Luling on the West Bank that's only open 2 days a week. It's called Gonzo's Barbecue. And Gonzo is a man named Jason Gonzalez, who I've been following for a few years. He started as a pop-up and quickly transitioned into having a barbecue shop. But like I say, it's only open a couple days because he has a lot of catering. He's located just on River Road, just right before the bridge, downriver from the bridge. You have to know it's there to know it's there. But believe me, people know it's there. It's the kind of place where you have to, you're best advised to pre-order. And then you queue up and you can get your order of your barbecue. You make specialty boudin sandwiches, that kind of thing. On Thursdays, it's burgers. On Fridays, it's the barbecue, the main act. But he went a little out of his realm to do tacos and po' boys and swept. So the judges were unanimous at two different events. Wow. So it was pretty interesting. Yeah.
Would there be a way to describe the barbecue that he makes? Is it like Carolina or Memphis or Texas?
Texas. What? It's definitely Central Texas style, the kind of barbecue you're getting around Austin. Mm-hmm. Famous for the brisket around that area, and Gonzo's is also. He does wonderful things with burnt ends, which are the bits at the end of the brisket that get extra smoky, extra fatty. He does pork burnt ends that follow the same kind of thing. And like I said, specialty boudin. So boudin often made with brisket sometimes, or with pork jowl. So for the extra fatty, that means extra tasty, extra good. So it's a really interesting spot, and it's worth an outing. And it's a real gem for that part of the West Bank in particular. And kudos to Gonzo for sweeping those award categories. And another one that did really well at both events is Southern's, a place you and I have talked about. Again, started as a pop-up and just opened a restaurant in Metairie on Vets near Clearview just over the summer. And Southern's is known for their fried chicken sandwiches, but they color outside the lines for these festivals and do some really good po' boys and tacos. And if you go to Southern's, you got to get the crackling. That's something that that listeners ask us about quite often. So that's a real good spot for crackling these days. It's new on Vets and Metairie, Southern's. So great to see those guys doing well at the festivals.
How you spelling that?
Southern's, as in the South, someone from the South, Southern.
And where is it?
It's on Vets in Metairie.
I was looking it up. I couldn't find it.
Yeah, Southern's.
Huh.
If you type into the internet machine Southern's McNulty NOLA.com, you'll get a story popping up with all kinds of photos and background.
By gosh, I'm looking at it right now. It looks delicious.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. The computer machine.
If you want to find it, put my name at NOLA.com and what you're interested in, and it's going to pop up.
Okay.
I've learned that myself.
All right, what else you been eating?
Well, it's been a busy week of restaurant news. Let me catch you up on a couple of things. One I think will be of particular interest is the restaurant Bon Ton. You ever been to Bon Ton?
Have not heard a lot about it.
Yeah, well, a lot of people have because it's been around for a long, long time. Been around since 1877. And for this particular story, we got to rewind to the halcyon days of early March 2020. When COVID, we had heard about it, but it was somebody else's problem. Not for long, of course. But before COVID had really materialized around here, Bon Ton closed. The longtime owners, the Pierce family, Wayne and Debbie, decided to hang it up, retire. And they said they were selling the business. It wasn't quite a done deal yet, but that was it. They were retiring just the same. And one way or the other, they were closing the doors. And there was a big mournful goodbye. Cheerful but mournful at the same time, as these things are when you recognize a place has to close, has to change, but you wish them well, but you're going to miss them. And that's the kind of place Bon Ton was. I mean, it was kind of the restaurant that introduced generations of people in New Orleans to Cajun food, actually. The proprietors, their generation before them, had taken over this old restaurant. Again, it's been around since 1877. But this family, the Pierce family, took it over in the 1950s and introduced recipes from the region they were from, which was around Houma, down in the Bayou region, down Bayou Lafourche, Bobby Hebert territory, and introduced crawfish dishes. And, this sounds like what everyone's looking for now, but it was highly unusual back then. And think about it, a generation before Paul Prudhomme came around, Bon Ton was serving Cajun dishes, serving etouffee and crawfish bisque, and it was a real unique place. And through the years, it became sort of a time capsule. I mean, you'd walk in there as of early 2020, and it was waitresses in these sort of matronly white dresses and white sneakers, looking like nurses from a hospital from the 60s. There was no computer system. Everything was transmitted to the kitchen by handwritten on order pads. And they didn't open on the weekends because back in the old days, the CBD was dead on the weekends. So why do any business down there? That was back when office buildings outnumbered hotels, not vice versa. So it was a real pleasing time warp with really good food. And it was sad to see them go. But that was pretty much the last anybody heard of it was March 2020. Then COVID happens, everything gets upended. But lo and behold, behind the scenes, a new buyer had come in, had bought it from the Pierces with all intentions of reopening, had to put that on hold during COVID, start turning the wheels on it. Just about to open this time last year when a fire struck. A fire broke out overnight. No one was hurt, thank goodness. But it set them back the entire renovation. They had to start from scratch. But here we are a year after that travesty, and they are weeks away from reopening. So there's a story on NOLA.com right now, or you can look up Bonton McNulty, NOLA.com, like what's been coaching, and it'll just come up.
That's on the computer machine, Instagram, right?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. At Ian McNulty NOLA on Instagram is another good way to find stuff like this. So it's going to reopen as a new restaurant, Tommy, called Bonton Prime Rib. Mm. That's the name of the restaurant, and Prime Rib is naturally the specialty. They're bringing back some of the dishes from the Bonton days, some dishes inspired by the Bonton days, but as the man who's opening it told me, this is not your father's Bonton nor your great-great-grandfather's Bonton, because that's how far back the Bonton name goes. It'll be a new restaurant channeling some of the past and bringing back a grand old restaurant space. Now, here's the interesting twist. The owner is a man named Jerry Greenbaum, and he also owns the Chop House, which is a steakhouse just across the street on Magazine Street in the CBD. It's where Cuvée used to be. Right. It's by the the Board of Trade building. And that is a really good standout steakhouse. It's part of a restaurant group that Jerry co-founded that has about a dozen restaurants around the Southeast. I don't call it a chain, really. You know, it's not like Applebee's or something like that. It's more akin to, like, Houston's, you know. Like, there's a number of units. They're good operations. They're a little more high-end. They're in different cities, but they're, you know, they're held together by not even necessarily the same names, but the same kind of operating principles and same owners and operators. And so Chop House is the one in New Orleans and now soon to be Bonton Prime Rib. And I had a glance at the menu. The full menu is online on my story, and I'm really excited about it. If you're a Prime Rib fan, and I know sometimes listeners do call in with that request, this is going to be your place. Now, I've not tried it, mind you, but talking to the operators and seeing the emphasis they're putting on the menu, it's really going to be the key to this place. I mean, it's written into the name, Bonton Prime Rib. So that's interesting. And they're going to serve a prime rib. That's not a typo. That is a prime rib cut from prime beef. And they're, like I said, they're really making a focal point of the place. So great to see that place coming back. I think that's going to be a good thing for downtown New Orleans. And I think it's going to be an interesting new addition with some old fashioned Cajun dishes with a new look and a lot of beef.
Somebody texted in, and this is not a bad question, about the difference between prime rib and ribeye.
Ah, yes. Okay. So your ribeye, they're coming from the same place, but a prime rib is, you got a picture.
You mean the same restaurant or same place on a cow?
Well, the same general vicinity on a cow.
Okay.
They're both coming off the rib section. The ribeye is that very end of the rib. Prime rib is, you're getting the whole rib bone in there. This is a massive cut. It's if a restaurant is serving prime rib, these are not individually cut rib, like steaks, like you might get somewhere else. This is this massive sort of brontosaurus-sized cut. I'm back in caveman costume mode here, Tommy. But this giant brontosaurus-shaped cut that they're roasting at once and then cutting into individual portions. And that's why you often see it as a special, because it's or the restaurant has to be heavily specialized around it, because it's the kind of thing where you don't just keep them on hand and like kind of cook one to order. You don't just cook, oh, I'm going to cook a prime rib. You know, you're cooking the prime rib and you're cutting it into orders. And so,
so the preparation is different. A steak you're grilling, and I got a question about a grilling steak in a minute, but the steak you're individually grilling, the prime rib, you're cooking this huge piece of beef in a different manner, right?
You're roasting it. Yeah.
Roasting.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. All right, there you go. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Somebody's looking for a steak that's cooked on a grill, not in a pan or not in butter, whatever that means. Somebody else looking for the best laid-back combination seafood restaurant market. Somebody else asking about oysters. Somebody wants to know about a Cuban sandwich on the West Bank. Somebody else wants to know about the Redbird Chicken in Lakeview. So a lot of questions coming in for Ian McNulty. You can join yours in the queue if you like at 504-260-1870. It's the Oakmont Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Tommy Tucker, I'll pass him along. We come back on WWL. 9:30 Friday morning. That's when we talk to Ian McNulty. Covers food and dining for the Times-Picayune, NOLA.com, New Orleans Advocate. He just covers it for anybody. You want to know about food, call him. He'll let you know.
New Orleans. That's who I'm covering it for.
Somebody wants to know where they can go to have a heated debate about the presidential race. Just kidding. Somebody is looking for a combination seafood market restaurant, the best laid-back place.
Okay, well, Porgy's is the your go-to. This is a newer place. It's in Mid-City. It's on the same block as Angelo Bricado's. It used to be Bevy Seafood before this, but Porgy's is exactly that. It's a seafood market where you walk in and there's a case that's filled with, they got shrimp, they got crabs, they got oysters. But what I'm really excited about is they have fish, okay? And I'm not saying this facetiously. You go into a lot of seafood markets around South Louisiana, for crying out loud, and it's a lot of shrimp, some crawfish in season, and then maybe some catfish, maybe some drum. If you're lucky, a piece of grouper. At Porgy's, you go in there, and there's probably, 8 to 10 different cuts of fin fish. We're talking about yellowfin tuna, pompano, whatever they're catching, different types of snappers, flounder, it's swordfish sometimes. It's great. It's what I remember seafood markets being a generation ago, but it's also fused to a restaurant. So it's sort of like a seafood market with a seafood deli, like going to the butcher shop that happens to make sandwiches. The best the best sandwiches you're going to get is out of a butcher shop. So this is the same idea, but for seafood. And so you can, there's a little bar, there's a couple tables out there. They have drinks. You can get, and then, get stuff for home. Get a clutch of oysters to shuck over the kitchen sink. Get some fish. You can make your own ceviche back home or toss some of that tuna on the grill. Porgy's is exactly what you're looking for.
All right. Somebody else looking for a steak that's made on a grill like a barbecue pit as opposed to being cooked in a pan.
Yeah, I think I know what they're looking for. I mean, the classic New Orleans steak that arrives sizzling in butter. They're going to be grilled, but they're coming to you on that hot plate, jumping with butter. You want more of the taste of the grill, right? I think that's what the listeners are asking for, a little bit of that char. Your Latin American steakhouses are superb for this. So La Boca or Brasa would be the ones. La Boca is down the Warehouse District. Brasa is on Metairie Road in Old Metairie, or they have a new, much more upscale place in Canal Place, where the old Morton's Steakhouse used to be, mm-hmm. in the Canal Place Mall downtown on Canal Street. And both these places, similar style. It's that South American way with steak, where they're cooking it a little slower, a little more slow and low over the grill. And it picks up a lot more of the flavor from the actual what they're cooking it over, from the wood or the charcoal, and really interesting cuts too. Not just your ribeyes, your fillets. It's you want to ask the waiter a little bit about each cut of steak to get what you want. But really flavorful, and I love the way they serve them with like chimichurris on the side, these little kind of garlicky parsley, almost like a pesto kind of thing on the side. Just fantastic. I love a steak that way.
Somebody's looking for a Cuban sandwich in the West Bank.
Yeah, I was thinking about this on the break, Tommy, and really the only thing I'm coming up with is one spot, but it's an interesting one for sure. It's called Cafe Cubano, mm-hmm. or Cafe Cuba, excuse me, Cafe Cuba. And it's,
Cuba.
It's part of the, yeah, that's right, it's part of a flea market in Harvey. It's called the West Bank Flea Market. It's just off the West Bank Expressway. It's pretty well hidden. You have to know it's there. It's just before the Harvey Canal. If you're heading towards the Harvey Canal, well, heading towards the Harvey Canal either way. If you're heading towards Marrero, it's just before the Harvey Canal, and it's an old self-storage complex where they've turned these sheds and units into individual restaurants, food stands, stalls, walk-up windows, real down-home, mom-and-pop kind of operations, and they're mostly Latin American. There's a few other things thrown in there here there. But there's Dominican food, there's a lot of Honduran food, Salvadoran food, Mexican food, and this Cafe Cubo where you can get a Cuban sandwich there. And it's a really interesting visit, too. I mean, it's a different slice of life over there, but it's legit. It's all authentic.
Somebody's looking for raw oysters. They like to eat raw oysters, but it's not cold, and they don't know if it's good time to get a sack of them or box them, however you buy them. I think they sell them in a sack or not.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, you can get them about the sack. And this is getting into the prime time. I mean, you can eat them all year round, of course, but they are better as it gets a little colder, as summer turns into fall, and here we are November 1st. So yeah, it's coming around to prime Louisiana, the traditional reef harvested oyster time. This goes back to the seafood market, right? Like any self-respecting seafood market should have sacks of oysters available. So, call the one that's near you, see if they do. But the reliable ones for me, I'm going to mention Porgy's again, just because they're rocking it. They do regular oysters, and they do the newer kind, the kind that you and I have talked about, mm-hmm. the cultivated sort that are a little more expensive, but they're cleaner, they're smaller, they're more intense. They taste a lot like the oysters that you had on vacation up on the East Coast or the Pacific Northwest, but they're actually grown off of Grand Isle or grown down the Gulf Coast in near Mobile. They're local oysters that are just grown a different way. American Seafood is another great resource. They're in Gentilly, and it's mainly a distributor to restaurants. But during COVID, one of their flexes that they kept since is they set up a little market outside. So you pull up, and there's a warehouse where, busy doing seafood distributor things with trucks and hand carts and everything else. But right up front, almost like a lemonade stand underneath a tailgating pop-up tent, they set up a seafood stand with all kinds of fish on display, shellfish and oysters. And when I'm having a party and I need to get a sack of oysters to shuck 100 or so on the back deck, that's where I'm going for good old-fashioned St. Bernard Parish reef rock old-fashioned oysters.
And I got to shout out my guy Sal at Salvo's in Belchase. Great place as well if you want to eat there or take it out. I was watching a thing where they were interviewing a national oyster shucker, and they were going to teach the young lady that was the reporter how to shuck an oyster. And I thought, man, I hope they got Band-Aids or something, because she didn't have the chain glove on or anything like that. It was just a rubber glove. Thankfully, everything turned out okay, because that's a good way to wind up the emergency room. Somebody wants to know about the best egg rolls that rival the old House of Lee egg rolls.
I'm thinking of Chinese Kitchen on Carrollton Avenue over by just past Costco, because, yes, that's one of our landmarks now, just past Xavier University near Five Happiness. Chinese Kitchen is that classic strip mall Chinese restaurant joint, but they're making an egg roll that's bigger than your cell phone. It's that the people will... This is the egg roll of yore. This is a classic Americana 1970s egg roll. Everything there, big portions, usually a line out the door.
That's always one of my favorite Christmas songs, the egg roll of yore. what about Redbird Chicken in Lakeview? Did it close down? Somebody wants to know.
It did, yes. They closed that location. Redbird has a few locations. There's one in Covington. There's one in the West Bank. There's one up in Denham Springs. And they're in expansion mode, so those guys are growing. But they decided to close that one on Harrison, we're talking about, in Lakeview, because they're really looking for locations now to grow that have drive-through windows, because that's working out real well for them in other locations. But that location is set to become a new location of Desi Vega's Prime Burgers and Steaks. Shakes, not Steaks. Burgers and Shakes. Desi Vegas and Steaks at his other restaurants. Mm-hmm. So that will be a burger and shake place pretty soon. That must be fixing to open very soon if it hasn't just snuck itself open right now under our noses as we're talking about. I'm going to look that up when we get off the phone. But Redbird is still very much going, just not in Lakeview, and that's good chicken too. They were a past Fried Chicken Fest winner, in fact.
And somebody's looking for a couple of recommendations in Lakeview as we close it out.
Yeah, sure. Junior's on Harrison. I call it the new modern neighborhood restaurant. It's not your Mandina's or your Liuza's, but it serves kind of the same role. with a more diverse menu and a great bar. Francesca's by Katie's. You know, Katie's restaurant in Mid-City. Francesca's is down the street. That's terrific. The Backyard, great burgers, great old-fashioned, Tommy. I know you like those.
There you go.
And while we're talking about steaks, you know, it's going to be the Steak Knife. Old-fashioned place, been around for 50 years.
And Tim's telling me Outpost 45?
Outpost 45, great for drinks, good scene. It's right next door. It's a Steak Knife. Steak Knife, one of the best martinis I've had in ages, served at that bar.
Thank you, Ian McNulty. Have a great weekend. We'll take a break. Come back. WWL 941 Traffic Now. All right, here we go. Big weekend of college and NFL action. 9:45, quarter till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL, here to give you all the winners with Taking Vegas. My boy, JR. How you doing, JR?
I'm doing outstanding, Tommy. Appreciate you having me on. Happy Football Friday.
Happy Football Friday to you, my friend. An exciting season so far, huh?
Oh, my gosh. I can't even begin to tell you how great it's been. I mean, you know, when it comes down to it, look, guys, it's all about one thing and one thing alone, making sure that you've got great, and I mean great information, experts in your corner, and more importantly, being capable of managing your bankroll to show you how to really make the most out of being able to make money every week betting on these games. It's hard on your own. Don't shoot from the hip. Have somebody in your corner that actually knows what they're doing with real strategy. Now, I'm going to start you off with an absolute blowout winner this week. Okay, I've got an underdog that's going to win outright, and I've labeled it my underdog college football game of the year. It will win outright. It is absolutely free right now. All you got to do is actually text the word win. Text win to 545454, and you're going to get my underdog absolutely free via text message. All you got to do, text the word win to 545454 to get this college football underdog game of the year absolutely free via text message. Again, text win to 545454.
You said shoot from the hip. You don't want to shoot from the heart either, do you?
No, you can't. I mean, guys that are in New Orleans who are always betting LSU or the Saints, I mean, first 2 weeks of the season, the Saints worked out for you, but tell me how it's worked out since. It's been rough. You can't do that. Here's the one thing I heard a long time ago. One of the big names on radio used to say, bet against your own team so that if they win, yay, your team won. But if they lose, hey, you made a little something on it. I'm not a fan of that. I'm more of a fan of looking for the best in what I call the best situation to take your money and pounce on it. And you got to be careful. You got to make sure the percentage of your bankroll that you're putting into play is always in favor, or I should say, is always going to be in relation to the game that you're betting or the amount of games that you're betting. You don't ever want to put 50% of your bankroll on a single game because you love it. You got to be smart. The idea is to try to bet less than 5% of your overall bankroll on any one individual game. Now, of course, that means it comes down to the size of your bankroll, right? You don't want to be betting, you know, $2 on a game if your bankroll is only $50. You got to be careful. You got to know what you're doing. And there are aggressive ways to do this and still have conservative backstops in place. What I mean by that is knowing when to pull it back, when to take 35 or 33% off the top and make sure that you're not going to put yourself in harm's way. Or if you take a loss, to cut your bet by up to 50%, just like when you're winning, not doubling up, but maybe adding 20 to 50% on that, not even the next game, but the next group of games that you're going to bet. There's so much that goes into it, Tommy. It's hard to do in a five-minute interview.
And the other thing, JR, is it's not always about who wins or loses a game. There are bets within a game. I'm not talking about crazy prop bets. I'm talking about totals, et cetera.
Yeah, no question. I mean, look at last night. I mean, if you didn't hop on your computer by the end of the first quarter in the Thursday night football game and bet the under, you're crazy. I mean, you could see where that game was going. They were having a ton of trouble. Both teams, offensively, C.J. Stroud looked awful. And it's hard for me to say that because I love the kid. He's one of my favorite new players in the league. I loved him for Rookie of the Year last year. And, you know, he couldn't get out of his own way last night. And that's what happens when you get hit and sacked eight times in a game. You know, going to get rattled. And then Aaron Rodgers, especially in the first half of that game, missing throws to the weak side. It was just a recipe for an under, and I thought it was easy money, and we were able to give that out. We liked it before the game and loved it by the end of the first quarter.
I'm not going to hold you anything. I'm not asking you to predict anything, but the Super Bowl is here in New Orleans. It is 100 days from today. If you had to tell me some of the top contenders, who would you pick in the NFL right now?
Well, I mean, let's face it. You know that on the one side, you got the Kansas City Chiefs, who are winning football games and undefeated, with Patrick Mahomes leading the league in interceptions, with Baker Mayfield as well having 9 interceptions already this year. You take a look at what they're doing, and to be able to put it together when, you know, the best player in football is not playing his best football, tells me that, you know, that there's a reason that they are the favorite to win, and they're only plus 400 right now to be the team to come out on top when it's all said and done. Now, there are other teams I could think that can definitely give them a run for their money. I love the Detroit Lions, but I'm not going to sit here and tell you a team that's never even been to a Super Bowl and is one of the oldest teams in football is going to win the whole thing this year, especially with some of the injuries that they've taken on. And now, I mean, look, they're laying points on the road to Green Bay this week, which is absolutely crazy. But again, AFC, I like the Kansas City Chiefs. I think the Ravens will be there at the end of all of this. And I think a surprise team, if Russell Wilson keeps playing the way that he is, and they grab an offensive wide receiver before the deadline here, the Steelers could also be a team in the AFC that you got to watch out for. In the NFC, you know, I think it's really up for grabs right now. There are too many teams that are just vying for spots for playoffs right now. You know, the Eagles, they are the one team. If they can keep it together and they can, you know, keep the coaching at a high level, I think that they're going to be the team, one of the teams that are going to end up in the NFC Championship game, along with the Lions, along with the Packers. But that's about it in the NFC. You know, of course, you got the Vikings too, but
Watch me jinx them, JR. Here we go, right? Kansas City, storyline, you look at it, the first team to go undefeated since the Miami Dolphins, but in the current NFL with, you know, a 17-game season, and win 3 Super Bowls in a row. There's your storyline. That being said, I know, right? You're on fire with your picks, the picks you hand out. Last week, the rain kind of did us in. Tell me what your free pick is this week.
Listen, the fact that not only we won 8 weeks in a row, but it took literally an act of nature to take us off the pedestal. I mean, to have all that rain in the first and half of the second quarter, and then still it started raining down points for us, and then all of a sudden we were 5 points from getting that over, and it starts pouring rain again with 7 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. So there was nothing we can do about it. Can't foresee that type of weather when I'm giving out a game on Friday. So take that into consideration, guys, when I'm giving you these games. You got to go back and you got to look at the weather before you start putting in these games. Now, there's an easy one on the board this week. Joe Flacco coming in for the Indianapolis Colts because of the tap out by Anthony Richardson. Minnesota Vikings coming off a loss against a team that did get back some really good players and put up some real numbers on them. I think Minnesota not only bounces back, but one of the toughest places to play in the NFL, top 5 for sure, and the Colts are going to have trouble getting their play calls out there. Flacco, 17-year veteran in this game, think he's going to get cooked up. Look for the Minnesota Vikings not only to win, but easily cover in this matchup minus the 5.
All right, take us out, JR, with your underdog college game of the year.
Guys, like I said, ladies and gentlemen, I should say. We get a lot of ladies these days as well. It's all about making money and showing what you got, and that's what we do over here. Call now, or actually, all you got to do is text. Text the word WIN to 545454. Get my underdog college football game of the year absolutely free via text message. Guys, this is not a 1-point underdog. This is a dog that really should be the favorite, and you're going to get a real good return on your money for this one. So text the word WIN to 545454. Get this underdog college football game of the year absolutely free via text message. One more time, text the word WIN to 545454. As always, Tommy, a real pleasure. Love doing this interview every week, guys. Be safe, have fun, and go out there and make some money.
Thank you, JR.
In case we haven't met, I'm Dino Colombo. I represent people hurt by a truck. It's what we do every day. Busy roads, big trucks, bigger risks. Don't face it alone. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.